Hello world and welcome to TYHA podcast on TRS Radio. My name is Anglo. With me I have Nike.
Hello.
And we have our good friend and guest, Evening Star. How you doing?
What's going on? Not bad.
Another Aussie voice that's not Null. I forgot to invite him. He's back and active. So maybe we'll have him on again sometime soon. Hopefully. But how are you guys doing today?
Are you really Aussie? I mean, anybody who comes to the UK is just is Britain just when they land, when the plane hits the tarmac. That's when they become British.
Yeah, well, I mean, even more so with me because I was born in England, then family moved out to Australia and we came back. I just came back with the accent, so I'm not a true blue fucking Aussie. Yeah.
And leave it to the Anglos to see, like, all their former holdings is still part of their empire.
Yeah. Yeah,
it's like, can, you know, just move back and forth between the UK and Australia. It's just like it's like moving between North and South Carolina.
Yeah, I mean, it's only like the full way around the world, you know, no.
Right.
But we're an imperial people, we're a sea people, you know, that's just how we roll.
I always find it funny,
you're an olive oil people.
The lead singer of Men at Work is a, you know, natural born Scot, which is why he doesn't really sound totally Australian when he sings.
Yeah. Well, go on.
Oh, I was just noticed there's a lot of that going on in Australia, like in between UK and Aussie land.
Yeah, man. I mean, like, loads and loads of British people go out to Australia. I think it's like a large amount of the population is like first or second generation British. And then you even get Aussies go to Britain. But I think it's more so the other way around. Like, there's just a lot of space in Australia, so people go out there for that. And there's, you know, your odd job opportunity, which is why my family went out there for a bit. But yeah, I mean, there's just such an affinity among the cultures. Yeah, fuck, we're full. No more, you know, no more British people. Poor me cunts, as they say. But yeah, I mean, there's just such an affinity between the cultures. Like I've said before that, like, Australia is just a nation of a certain kind of person you'd meet down a pub in, like, England, you know. It's like a certain part of the British psyche just kind of found its way to Australia and became an entire country.
That's also a very uniquely English thing to have these far-flung colonies that you still somehow have a ethnic and cultural predominance over, you know, decades later, long after decolonization, that you can still have such strong ties to it that you just migrate between the two countries effortlessly.
Seamlessly, yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's part of it is aided just by, you know, modern communication and by the ease of travel. Because at this point, with the fact that it takes, like, you know, there's like a, I don't know how long the flight is, but there's like a non-stop flight from Heathrow to, I don't remember where it is in Australia, but to...
That's crazy to have a flight that far non-stop.
Yeah, man. It's like one of the longest flights in the world. But like the modern technology just means that it's basically because of like reducing distance, it's literally easier to trade with someone in New Zealand or Australia from Britain than it is in France because you've got the language is the same. And there's also just like, you know, the world's been opened up with like refrigeration and all of this sort of thing. So it's just like modern technology just kind of facilitates this sort of soft imperialism that you're talking about, Nico.
Yeah, I think of like the other, you know, side of far-flung distance in the Falklands. And that's not even decolonized. That's still part of the UK.
Oh, man, like the Falkland Islands, like the people in the Falkland Islands are just like completely British people. I mean, they have a weird as fuck accent, but, you know,
I've never heard it once in my life. I'll have to look it up.
I mean, there's only like 2,000 of them. It's like in the area of Scotland, but there's very few people in the Falklands. But like the Falkland Islands, it is just like a small, like windswept island in the middle of fuck off nowhere with some weird people and sheep. So it's just Britain in the South Atlantic, right? Like,
pretty Pretty much.
And they're actually British people, you know. It's just, I think they're like Scottish and Welsh or something.
I think the least British thing about them is that they haven't ever conquered like any holdings on the mainland in their existence yet.
Yeah, well, they haven't.
There's never been like a equivalent of Brittany in South America.
There's actually a Welsh speaking settlement in Patagonia in Argentina.
Mm.
Yeah, it's very interesting. There's like a small sort of Welsh community that migrated there. It's quite unknown, but it's
I heard about that. I don't know much about it.
Yeah.
Those weird communities always interest me, just like random.
Yeah, how the fuck do these cunts get there?
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what it's like. There's like fucking Arabs in Peru or some shit.
Yeah, like they have a big Chinese and Japanese community in Peru.
Peru had a prime minister named Fujimori.
Oh, shit. Yeah, that was it. That was, yeah, they had like.
And instead, they have a Jew named Kaczynski.
Oh, fucking oath. That's controversial.
Polish Jew named Kaczynski. I mean, Peru is just mess. I mean,
Peru. Christ. And they got Paddington Bear.
Mestizos was confusing enough, but now you have, like, you know, what do you get when you have a mestizo crossed with a Japanese person? I don't even know. They don't have a word for that.
The future.
Based is what that's called. Fucking based.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, Christ. I mean, they get the Incan Empire is what they get. Like... This is their primordial national myth is you know, the fusion of the mestizoid and the Asiatic. I don't know.
Rising sun to the setting sun.
Yeah,
but you know who else was supposed to settle Patagonia right before the Balfour Declaration?
Oh, is that so?
Yeah, you know, they were supposed to put the Jewish homeland in Patagonia. Hmm. It was one of the theorized resettlement plans of the day, but I guess between Palestine and Madagascar, they thought the mountains of deep South America were one possible alternative.
Well, Patagonia is like a big sort of plain to the east of the mountains, as I understand. It's quite nice land. It's quite arable. I think they have good vineyards there. I mean, it's populated by like Italians and Germans, most of Argentina, I think. Like, it's quite famously populated by the exact opposite of the Jews after World War II, right?
I thought most of the Argentine population was up north. And like, as you get into the mountainous south, there's like sparsely populated parts that are Patagonia, but I could be wrong.
I mean, I could easily be wrong as well, man. Like, yeah, I'm sure you're right about that.
I knew some broad from Argentina. She was just full Italian. I know there's a lot of Italian over there, but I
think it's the single biggest ethnicity is Italian. Not even Spanish. They're like the founding stock there, but they're not like predominant in Argentina. Because like Spain, while there's a lot of people, it's like 40 million or something. Like, in terms of population compared to Italy, France, and Britain and Germany, like, they've never had like the same degree of like a lot of people like to export. So they've always just kind of ruled over local populations compared to where we just replaced an entire continent with, you know, British people. And
yeah, remember Columbus wasn't even Spanish.
He was Italian, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I stand firmly by the Columbus was a Greek theory.
Yeah,
is that very popular in your circles, Nikkei?
Was he Venetian or Florentine? What was he again?
Mm-hmm. Well, the Italians would have you believe. I think he was Calabrian, but really, if you're woke to the facts of the matter, he was a descendant of late Byzantine royalty from the island of Chios.
Oh, right.
Uh-huh.
Fair enough.
Facts.
Well, I mean, there's a long...
In any case, not Spanish.
Yeah, Christ. But there's a long sort of seafaring tradition from Greece that he'd be an addition to. So it would make sense.
It's a valid theory, and I choose to believe it.
But Alexander the Great is Macedonian.
Yes, the Slavic speaking Macedonian,
which means Bulgarian. Yeah,
ancient Bulgarians.
Yeah.
That conquered the world.
Christ, the Balkans is such a fucking mess, man. Like, oh Christ! Like, I remember back in Australia, like we had quite a lot of migrants from like Eastern Europe towards the 80s and the 70s and that. And we had like a couple. I think it was one kid was either Serbian and Croatian. I think it was like a Serb or a Croatian or a Serb and a Bulgarian, and they just would not shut the fuck up about the Balkans, man. Like, it's like a microcosm of the whole world. Just everyone hates each other for some arcane reason, you know? And we're all just aliens looking on their little earth, you know?
A few other countries that Greeks get along with in the Balkans, we do not share a land border with.
Yeah. Yeah, well, it's like Bulgarians and Croatians like each other because they're both separated by Serbia. And right. Greeks don't like Bulgarians.
Can't have a land border with another country in the Balkans and like them. It's just a rule.
Yeah. So Slovenes and Croats hate each other then?
Possibly. I mean, they're both Catholic Slavic countries. I don't know why they're separated. I honestly can't tell you why.
Well, I mean, I imagine Slovenian is just like a extremity of, actually, is Slovenian related to like Czech and those languages, or is it like a Croatian type South Slavic language?
Let's see what this says.
I think it's South Slavic, isn't it? Less Czech than, less Croat than, say, Serbian is. That, you know, yeah. Croatian and Serbian are very similar, but Slovenian, I'm not really sure. I mean,
it's been like
the
South
farthest
Slavic
reaches of the Balkans.
Yeah, it says South Slavic on Wikipedia, but I imagine it's just like the northernmost on like a dialect continuum. Anyway, this is quite obscure stuff. I don't know if anyone would be interested in this.
Yeah, so tell me about
posting is evergreen.
So I heard about Evening Star. Well, first off, we're in some Twitter chat for EBL, which is a podcast I was on once. Euro Bureau of Literaturo. Nice philosophy podcast, mostly. I think they might branch out to other things, but we usually talk about philosophy texts and stuff like that. But I also found out about you through your National Idealism video. Very good video, my friend.
Oh, cheers.
So what is this national idealism you talk of? And maybe you could explain it to Nike, because he's not too familiar, and to the audience as well.
Certainly will. I'll give a nice Anglo-Saxon instruction to our Greek friend here.
There you go.
Yeah. Now, it was so national idealism is a term that I sort of I don't know if I coined it. Like, it's a pretty obvious addition of the two words. So, I mean, it just sort of logically follows from a certain like approach to nationalism that you do find in these circles, but I haven't seen it like formally articulated. So I sort of espoused this concept in this video through the ideas of Patrick Pearce, who was the visionary sort of leader of the 1916 rising in Ireland against British rule. And I sort of opposed it to what's in theories of nationalism called a socio-biological approach to what comprises the nation, which essentially is your bog standard. The nation is a genetic kin group, yada, yada, yada. Like, we support it for genetic interests, which none of which I like disagree with. But there's a more sort of profound point to it when you look at the work of Pearce and someone like this, which is an allegiance to an idealized or rather just an ideal of what the nation is, which is like vested in the great works of the nation or in sort of this ethnic spirit and this ethnic sort of self-actualization that you see in Ireland through like their like traditions. And you'd see in like all sorts of nations, you have this history, which is the manifestation of an ideal. And I think the difference which emerges between these two approaches, as I like articulated in the video, was that in the socio-biological approach, there's a pure sort of materialism. where whatever is in the genetic interests of your particular group is what is like considered righteous. Whereas in the ideal sort of conception of it, there's a concern more so about perhaps the dignity of your group or the integrity in adherence to this ideal. So the sort of, I'd say like the biggest kind of point that I made in the video in like a practical sense is that while theoretically you could have a kind of Walmart, you know, dystopia sort of shopping mall that was 100% white and was like ethnically completely cohesive, you know, like you had the integrity of like your entire ethnicity, but it was in this kind of nightmarish modern scenario where everyone's like addicted to pornography, that would not really be any better than one which was ethnically mixed, you know, like that same scenario. So it's kind of like restoring this ideal vision, so it's like reclaiming our countries for the purpose of better manifesting an ideal notion of who we are and who we can be is sort of what I'm getting at.
Yeah, no, I have a deep respect for that because, you know, oftentimes I find myself thinking that a degenerate homogenous society would be at least a relatively better starting point for improvement than what we have today, which is both degenerate and heterogeneous. But I think keeping sight of that vision of what you really are aiming for is important. Otherwise, you know, you risk slipping into some vision of, I guess you would call total Aryan victory, which neglects the
total Walmart victory.
Yeah. Which neglects this important aspect of what we're striving for.
Yeah, because we're not striving for a society, a consumer society that's white. We're striving for an England that glorifies Shakespeare, not an England that glorifies Tesco or whatever, you know. It's
yeah, man. I just see it as like another aspect of the decline of modernity, really. It's just like another, it's just another sort of way in which we are being taken away from the better way of being that we used to.
What I thought was interesting about your video is how you referenced Pierce, and obviously you're, you know, English, but you're willing to engage with an Irish nationalist who maybe some more reactionary type British nationalists would view that as kind of haram to be referencing an Irish nationalist who was fighting against, you know, your empire. Why would you do that? I like your approach of just willing to engage with these thoughts and not thinking in this restricted set. You know, there is something admirable about some of the, you know, Anglo-Saxon imperialism, but there is a sense that a lot of the people in England have lost that sense of being rooted in the soil. And it's about expanding, you know. Maybe there should be like a turn inward and like self-reflection, maybe.
Yeah, it's like Enoch Powell said, we need to leave behind the idea of being an empire and become a nation again.
Yeah.
And that's... I certainly think he was right to say that. But yeah, like I think ultimately in that video and in Pierce's works, we both sort of espouse an opposition to what we see as the fruits of modernism and just modernity. And Pierce identified that with the British Empire, with the materialization and the kind of quantitative reasoning, the instrumental thought with which everything was governed, as producing this modern society in which he saw Irish people as being denatured and taken away from the ideal of who they could be. And he even goes as far as to say that in this sort of denatured state, the Irish would be better off dead, which is a very radical thing to say. But I mean, that's kind of my position. Like, take it back to the shopping mall. Like, in our current state, it would be a mercy to just kind of, you know, flip the switch almost. And that's not to say that I want us to go extinct, but if we're not going to, you know, kind of claw back as you were saying, a more ideal form of who the English should and could be, that's attached to the soil and attached to some more ideal notion of who and what we are, then it doesn't really serve a sufficient end, because I don't think just material existence is an end in itself. It's like, yeah, being alive is obviously will to power at its like most sort of fundamental state, and that's obviously something that's a prerequisite, but I don't just live for the sake of living. You know, I want to do something or extend it's into striving. The world. Yeah, exactly. And
instead
that's
just mere existence.
Yeah, precisely. And as you were talking about with the English thing, being willing to discuss theories of Pierce, I think basically they're not, while they are particular to Ireland, and I think it does reflect a very kind of Gaelic mindset, the whole way of which he approaches things, I think ultimately he talks about the nation as in a generic sense. You know, he talks about it as it basically a human universal that can be particularized to different types of, or to different specific national contexts. But it applies to, you know, his like theorizing about the nation applies to my own just as much as it does to his.
Yeah.
What I was talking about with that materialist, instrumental, quantitative approach to the world, I would see that as, you know, the British Empire at the time in his mind, and I can see why he thought this, was just the vessel for that modern sort of implicit philosophy, and the fruits of that, I think, are the disgusting modern world that we see around us. And I think that has enslaved and ensnared the English just as much as it did the Irish through us. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, I made this point in the video as well, Sargon of Akkad and people like that are now trying to sell to us that English nationalism is an affirmation of those like modern ideologies that are themselves a negation of English national existence ultimately, which is just retarded. So yeah, I discard any notions like that, and I embrace Pierce's sort of approach to the nation.
So you also made an interesting analogy about like animals and
I was about to save you there. It's about to save you there. Did you say factory farming?
Yeah, there
you
go.
I'll take it from there.
So factory farming, what's that about?
Oh, yeah. Well, in the video, yeah. It's just another point that I made to do with the different conceptions of like nationhood and of genetic interests. Because if the nation is just this sociobiological entity, as people like Van den Berg and some other scholars would say, then if you compare the human animal to sort of factory farmed animals like chickens and cows and all of these sorts of species that are subjugated by man, then in like pure evolutionary terms, they are more successful than any species ever. Like, you know, they have extremely high biomass, extremely high populations. Like this, If like the only purpose and telos of the nation is just to reproduce itself, then a nation that was analogous to a factory farm species would be like the height of success. Do you see what I mean? Like, yeah, in terms of just pure genetic like information being passed on, that is the height of success.
But they're stuck in a cage where they shit on each other.
Yeah. Like it's this question of dignity, which means that it can't just be a material calculation. The nation must be something ideal. Otherwise, just abject slavery and ignobility is just from like an acceptable position.
From like a practical perspective, I don't think people will get very passionate about like fighting for Costco. And if you want to rile up the masses,
I don't know, man. Have you ever seen like a Black Friday?
Oh, maybe. Costco is a crazy place. The fact that you could buy like a package of 50 eggs is insane. When my grandpa had to work on the farm and watch them chickens all day, make sure you just get like a few eggs.
Yeah, man.
It's crazy.
I'll tell you what, my grandparents literally went from the farm to having the Costco sized grocery store amount, and they pay for that membership. So it speaks to the mindset of when you're actually living in that, to the being enticed by what the American lifestyle has to offer. I mean, from my own experience of, you know, witnessing my family, they're sold into it, and, you know, they're still traditional people by any other stretch of the word.
Well, this is the soft coercion of this sort of modern paradigm where
it's very seductive.
Did I cut you off there, mate? Sorry.
I just said it's a very seductive offer there, like just the economic lifestyle of it and the consumptive patterns are subtle, but so much easier.
Well, just the kind of sheer productive weight that a purely kind of quantitative approach and like driving everything, governing everything by economic rationality, like does produce a fuckload of stuff.
Think about the impossibility of the alternative in America as opposed to, you know, the old country, so to speak.
Yeah.
You know, when my parents or my grandparents were living in the village in the early 20th century, you know, that's all they had. But you don't even have the option to be that simple peasant farmer and sustain your life at all after you immigrate to America.
Well, I mean, even in Europe, as this kind of, as that system that especially economically just sort of takes hold, then you lose the ability to maintain the organic community that you've had in those countries.
Very true.
You just lose that ability immediately. Like first when sort of private property and the ability to trade goods throughout an entire country and then like even internationally, suddenly that entire old organic community just kind of breaks apart and everything is just based on where you can sell shit. So in like a country like my own life, where did my family move to? They moved to Australia because my dad could get a job there. And then we moved back because we just wanted, you know, it's like the calculation is not where will Evening Star be able to have like a nice community of friends and just sort of grow up. And, you know, like it's not about finding your place qualitatively in the world and having just this kind of richness of experience that goes along with that. Instead, it's just about serving the machine, and wherever the machine deigns that you as a single unit will be deposited is where you were, you know, sent off to. And it's all done through soft coercion. You're never forced to formally, but it's this soft, seductive, coercive force that just kind of automatously sorts you into wherever is most productive.
I guess, you know, as Smith would put it, the invisible hand, so to speak. The
invisible hand holds a knife to your throat.
Yeah.
Ooh, that's a good one.
I came up with that quite a while ago, and I'm really fucking proud of it, not going to lie.
That's a good one, because if you known the bitches I know, they would both be threatening and very hot if you held a knife to their throat. And, you know, it just speaks to the sort of wider insanity of that kind of world order, in the same way that it's insane for this girl to, like, you know, be turned on by this life-threatening scenario, so too are we pulled in by the you know, soul-threatening scenario.
It's deep, man. We're engaged in
economic order.
We're engaged in economic BDSM.
You're not wrong. It's
last. Do you name your episodes?
Yes.
I think we might have an episode.
Yeah, we do. Right. That's
I think we have, my friend. Unless we can top this somewhere later in the conversation, this is very poignant. Yeah. I think you've hit on something extremely, like, salient here.
Thanks.
Do you think this is a inevitability of trade? Because, you know, trade and export and import has existed for millennia. Is this necessarily a consequence of that system, or was there any way we could have avoided this?
we'll see. Are either of you guys familiar with the French theorist Jacques Ellul?
Yeah, we had Keith Woods on, and he talked
about it. Oh, you've had Keith on?
Yeah, he talked a little bit about that.
All right.
Not in like extreme detail.
Credit to Anglo with more familiarity than I do.
Yeah. Well, I mean, he's got a lot of great stuff about Ellul. He's really summarized a lot of his ideas really succinctly and put them to good use, I think. But Ellul's sort of main ideas about technique, right, which is this self-propelling logic of technological. You sort of understand what it is, and if you want to know what it is, just like look it up. But it's, you know, it's this self-propelling ethic that exists in a society of like instrumental rationality. And the difference between classical trade, Nike, and like what you see now and the modern sort of paradigmatic delineation that I see is when we transferred from an old world vision of, you know, a sort of world governed by God or governed by whatever it is. And we went from this sort of qualitative understanding of the world, and we sort of went into this mode of being in the modern world where things are understood just in terms of their quantity, you know, this kind of atomistic philosophy of what the world is. It's kind of like C.S. Lewis talks about how somewhere in between, oh God, who was it he said? But like he says that there was just this transition from what he calls the Christian into the post-Christian, but you could easily just say, you know, like the traditional into the modern sort of understanding of the world and the way that the world just revealed itself in general. And I think that as soon as you have this quantitative ideology as the kind of presumptive mode of engagement with the world, that's when you start to see this sort of newer and I would say pernicious transmutation. Because while you had trade in the ancient world, never was challenged the idea that you would have a local community that would sort of be broadly self-sufficient. You know, you wouldn't have this kind of idea of just absolute borderless international exchange based on whatever happens to be like economically
a zeitgeist of fungibility.
Oh, completely, yeah. And it's a zeitgeist change, which I think is the difference there, because you're saying, is it inevitable? And I think it's the inevitable fruit of a change in spirit and a change in philosophy, which I think are ultimately kind of the same thing.
Well, that doesn't really answer the question then. So what was it that changed? Because if it was an inevitable product of that change, well, it begs the question of what caused the change.
Well, then that also begs the question of, can you produce a causal model of history, or does history that's true, yeah. I mean, perhaps it's some kind of dialectical thing. Perhaps it's something to do with, you know, some kind of perennial understanding of, you know, yugas and ages. Maybe it's something to do with that. I think maybe you could take it to a Spenglerian place. In fact, Oswald Spengler actually wrote some sort of techno-critical. He wrote, was it Man and Technics, I think, which was a precursor to Ellul. So I'm sure you could bring those sort of ideas. I don't claim to have like a complete knowledge of, I mean, you could look at sort of structural explanations for why it came about, when and where it did, where it came about in England and the Low Countries, really, this sort of economic rationality, which was a kind of manifestation of quantitative ideas that were coming about at the time. And you can see it just as, you know, the new landed merchant classes of these countries needed sort of a philosophical underpinning and justification for the idea of private property and of, like, you know, eventually factories and division of labor and all of this, which is where you could sort of orient it that way around, where the economic sort of need and the economic prospects of this particular class engendered an entire sort of philosophy. But I don't claim to have like a final answer.
I would tend towards that sort of explanation, but More specifically in that the sort of empowerment and rise of the mercantile class, looking for an explanation, they had an explanation. And it's that over-application and extension of the merchant's worldview towards the other classes that engendered this outlook on everything.
Well, that just became the dominant view.
Right. It's because the mercantile class enriched itself, and enrichment inherently led to political power and prominence. And it wasn't, it was in their short-sightedness and insistence on the primacy and maybe exclusive legitimacy of their worldview and enforcing it as such, which led to the sort of overreaches we see today. There, I think there was always a place for a mercantile class in civilization. In civilized society, you know, trade occurs because, you know, an implicit trade imbalance where one country or locality can produce something better than another can, and they trade for what the other can produce better than they can. If you follow what I mean, it's, you know, that very early Ricardian imbalance that leads to the necessity of trade. And I think that's, you know, pretty straightforward, and was, it's very much demonstrable and consistent throughout human history. But what changed was the power wielded by that mercantile class and their decision to insist upon their worldview as the only way of viewing and evaluating the world. You follow what I mean, or am I not clear?
Can you still hear me?
Yeah.
All right. In answer to Nikkei's point there, I think ultimately what you see with the coming of the bourgeois supremacy is essentially a worship of efficiency, because for the bourgeois, the absolute kind of zenith of, you know, like the best thing to pursue it, and the thing that they're geared towards, is maximizing efficiency, because that's their sort of, that's their sort of purview. Where for an aristocrat, it's maximizing, you know, I don't know what the other sort of priorities, where it's, you know, I suppose it becomes an idea of noblesse oblige at some point, or it's just good sort of leadership qualities. And then as J.R.R. Tolkien says in his, I think it's in the essay on fairy stories, where he says that the modern world witnesses improved means to deteriorated ends, which is sort of talking about this worship of efficiency as the one sort of the absolute sort of determiner of all things around you. And this is when you just have all regard for the quality of human experience is thrown out, and the world is then created in order to be the most efficient, the most kind of productive. This is just the one value which is enshrined above all other, above all others. And yeah, that's how the modern world just sort of comes about, is when you have this reflexive and unquestioned worship of efficiency. It becomes basically like some kind of god, where the only kind
of course, the only way
the death of God, and we replaced it with another god,
efficiency. Yeah, and the only way to justify any kind of political policy is in this bourgeois language of, is it good for the economy? You know, is it efficient? When this just reflects that the absolute value that cannot be questioned is, does it service the machine? Do you know, do either of you guys like the band Have a Nice Life? You heard of them?
No, it sounds vaguely familiar.
Death Consciousness album? No.
No, I don't.
I can't say I've ever heard of them.
Okay, well, there's this one lyric from their the last song on their album, Death Consciousness. It's about this sort of golem, which is swallowing the world and churning out just, you know, like nothing. It's about basically the consumptive sort of, it's kind of about technique in a way. You can read it like that. It's about sort of this robot, this golem consuming the earth. And I think the lyric goes like, an army of the golems is stalking now, eating all reality, producing only dust and sand, which is what I see happening, is because you can't ever really put a halt on this. Instead, it's just this endless self-perpetuating process that will consume everything it needs to sustain itself and to just sort of keep on this endless process. Elul says that it's just like endless means without ends, really. It's like means are themselves an end, because efficiency, which is an adjectival sort of aspect of, you know, ends usually, is now the end in itself.
Right. So, I think that is like the apotheosis of that comparative advantage worldview, like I was talking about with Ricardo. It's, you know, unlike Ricardo ever could have imagined, it's seeking to increase that comparative advantage to a, you know, a level unknown of before. You know, when you, it doesn't take a genius to recognize that a comparative advantage is something desirable for an economy to possess. And so, you know, because it's easily recognizable, you have that sort of universal orientation towards improving efficiency and dedicating oneself and one's techniques, if you will, to improving efficiency.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, it's like that is an end in itself, something which usually is just the augmentation of the ends in order to achieve them.
Ricardo,
and
then this I don't think Ricardo could have theorized in any world that he witnessed, you could just undo or reverse the comparative advantage that you had.
Mm.
I think he sort of saw it as a fixed thing for a time and a place, and that, you know, any sort of change to that order would require, you know, dramatic alterations to the, you know, international economic organization.
Mm. It ultimately requires like a completely different spirit. In fact, I think it requires a rebirth of idealism, which is why I, you know, support national idealism. In order to defeat this, you just need to reorient man's entire relationship with being, and it needs to be oriented away from this worship of efficiency and this quantitative thinking. It needs to just be oriented back towards God or the gods, or towards just you know,
nation, ethnos, or whatever.
Yeah just see, I'd sort of like, the reason I don't just call myself a nationalist is I think that, as I said earlier, is just that this whole sort of racial chaos is just one more aspect of modernity's downfall, as I see it. Mm-hmm. So like that sort of like adherence to nationalism, if you want to call it that, or ethnic loyalty, is just one more sort of shade, one more sort of aspect of an organic, rooted, ideally sort of focused way of being. Yeah, Weltanschauung, which is like worldview, right?
Yeah.
Or like world looking, I think, is one translation, because like is like to see.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a great word.
German's world, language. Love it.
World outlook.
Yeah, it could be translated multiple ways, but this is another reason why like philosophy is very important, because I've had people, we've kind of charted my journey through philosophy a little bit on this podcast. I started getting into Heidegger like a year ago. I talked a little bit about that.
Good shit, man.
Yeah, I talked a little bit about that on the podcast, and I was talking about a little bit of the other things I was reading, like Kant.
And the essay on technology is completely relevant to all of this.
But, like, I had someone in the comments say, like, this is just stupid. Why are you talking about philosophy? This is retarded.
Retards.
And it's like, this benefits no one. What does this do? It's like, but if you want to... you know, you have to understand like the greater like philosophical reason for our problem. You know, it's not as simple as like, yeah, we have invaders in our country and then there are these people that rule over us, but you got to understand like, I guess a greater spiritual malady or, you know, that it,
not completely,
that it exists in all of Europe or European derived countries. And it's like,
I'd say even wider than that.
Yeah. Worldwide. It's just like, it's something that can't be, I don't know. We need time for thinking.
We need intellectual curiosity again. This is what we had coming into this. Nobody came into this sort of, you know, what was the alt-right and is now the dissident right. Like, nobody came into it out of doctrine. And then they seem to come out the other side, these sort of programmed sort of fucking robots repeating talking points. We don't need that. We, like, right now, we need people to be open to different ways of conceiving of the world. And, you know, that's not to say we should discard our ideas or anything like that, but it's just, you know, everything's fucked. We need to, fucking seriously think. Like, a lot of thinking needs to be done, and it's not being done to my satisfaction in a lot of places. Like, you have a lot of what I would call sort of like Philistine reaction to, as you were saying, like reaction to philosophy, which a lot of right-wing and conservative reactionary type people are so quite unphilosophical, and they do just like have these natural ethnic feelings of, you know, get these fucking foreigners out of my fucking country. And that's like, that's fine. That makes sense. That's completely like, cogent and makes absolute sense. But at the same time, we need, not just for the purpose of nationalism itself, but it's just like, it's unbecoming of us as who we are to not ponder the absolute and the universal and the meaningful. And that's where ultimately, you know, what is this entire sort of golem, this machine that is consuming the fucking world, this quantitative machine that I talk about as, you know, kind of embodiment of everything I see is wrong with the world. That is the spawn of ideology. That is the spawn of philosophy.
Yeah, exactly.
So you can't just counter it as if it is standing in front of you as a literal machine. I mean, it is in some places. That's why you should go Ted-pilled and, like, I don't know, break your fucking dishwasher or something. But, you know, like, you see what I mean?
You didn't read Jeffrey Tucker's recent article, did you?
Oh, Christ. Is it warning about eco-fascism or something?
No, it was talking about dishwashers.
How amazing they are, maybe.
He was commenting on something Trump had brought up at a rally recently.
We have the best dishwashers since I've been in presidency.
No, we have the worst dishwashers, actually. Was his point.
Jesus. So he's like Captain Efficiency. Like, he's a libertarian that is like, you know, the whole yes meme, yes full stop, Nordic gamer.
Right,
He's like that. Like, everything we're saying, he just like embraces it. You always have to respect
his
goal. He's like
the Coomer with the bow tie saying,
yeah.
Yeah. Fuck.
Oh, you're a materialist. Yes. Everything
never
has to be.
I had a conversation with him, but I, you know, had an occasion where I was at the same place as him once. And, you know, he was just raking in the fame and admiration. He's just an asshole.
Is he the one that like worships Taco Bell and says, look how amazing
he's like
this
the
is?
McDonald's,
that cunt.
Yeah.
Mozzarella stick sycophant.
It's amazing.
They are fucking good, though. They are fucking
They're good, but good, like, if that's. That's the. Like, that's the.
That's the
limit.
The seduction that Nikkei was talking about.
Well, that's the extent of a lot of people's ideology now. It's just like, I want some good cheese sticks. You know, it's like,
well, I
mean,
I can get them from McDonald's for a dollar.
This is what I've been referring to as Neo-Epicureanism, which is, you know, you had Epicurus was this Greek philosopher who had this standpoint that pleasure is essentially happiness. It's this hedonistic idea of what makes people happy. And of course, that's assuming that happiness is the goal of life anyway, which I would dispute. But even so, like, contentment in man is not just, it's like, you guys ever play Civilization 5? like the way to make your citizens happy is to give them more fucking meaningless luxury goods. Mm-hmm. Like that's not how people work. And like, you know, in that game, which is itself just a completely neo, like it reflects a completely Whig view of history, like humanist celebration of like progress and the myth of progress and all of that. And as you get into the modern era in that game, your people just get happier and happier and it never tapers off. And there's never this point where more and more luxuries becomes meaningless. And in that kind of, you know, programmed world, which is completely quantitative, unlike our own, that works. But in our own world, people need ideals and people need something more than just material consumption. You can't just mozzarella stick your way to heaven, you know. And that's... It's a miss. I've been referencing this fellow, Hans Morgenthau, mostly writes about or wrote about international relations. He was a classical realist.
Oh, God. Morgenthau, the international relationist.
you are correct, but I mean, he was a very interesting fellow. And his he wrote this book, Scientific Man versus Power Politics, which is essentially like what I've been talking about in many ways.
Like democracy versus authoritarianism.
Not so much that. It's more about how the scientistic philosophy of his day hindered a proper application of social science or proper investigations into social and cultural matters. So he talks about how the scientistic philosophy completely misconstrues who man is. He sees him as just this rational robot who can be sated with certain material inputs, which is not man at all. Man is like part rational, part irrational, part, right. You know.
I mean, the thing about the rational analysis of man is that it's the best we can come to something universal, something that hold cultural.
It's the basis of humanism. It's the basis of humanism, isn't it? Yeah, which is itself just an anthropocentric rebellion against nature.
But it's an at the bare minimum, it's an understanding of man as something. And it implicitly recognizes differences, but in that recognition, it tries to find that, you know,
commonality.
Part of that Venn diagram, that tiny overlap of, that commonality. Where, okay, at least we can say this much about all of us.
But then, like,
even
so
then,
this
it's like, I'm skeptical about that shit.
Yeah.
And you should.
Yeah, you should be. And this gets us back to the question of idealism and materialism, because you have, C.S. Lewis and a lot of other Christian thinkers have talked about the commonality of man, and that's a Christian idea, is that everyone is one in Christ, all men contain a soul and a made in the image of God. And that is an ideal notion of the way in which man is one, you know, like man is one in this ideal. But now with liberalism, which is just a secularization of Christianity, that's been materialized.
And man liberal is one in his consumption.
Yeah. Liberal humanism has rendered it so that man is literally materially, for no metaphysical justification at all, because they've gutted liberalism of God, which was the basis for all of it, with no real actual justification at all, man is materially the same in some sense.
Isn't
and it's just this anthropocentrism.
That everybody loves Baby Yoda.
Yeah. Fucking hell. There's this one girl, like, will not stop sending me fucking Baby Yoda memes.
She's again, caring about what women think politically.
No, I mean it's not. I don't think it's political, but well, like
it sounds like you're trying to read into it more than you should.
Hey,
no,
I
was just blowing off some. I was just blowing off some steam with the lads.
But I just got to remind you that you know you're blowing off steam over something that you know you really shouldn't, because it's just women.
I'm just trying to have a laugh about the dumb fucking woman. I didn't expect a third degree, you know, okay?
I got to throw it back at you, my man. You are
right.
What is this Baby Yoda stuff? I've heard about it. I was doing finals when this.
It's fucking Reddit.
Is it literally? Oh, okay. I searched it up.
It's from that new Star Wars show, and it's like a fucking baby version of Yoda, and it's cute.
Star Wars put out a a TV show, technically.
It's Wholesome 100.
And, you know, there's this little little character in it that's a small version of Yoda. And we don't know who it is, but it's just a babby Yoda. Okay. And it still fits the anime niggas definition of adulthood, because technically it's 50 years old.
Oh.
Baby, I am.
I've actually never seen Star Wars.
You know, besides because it's got cute alien neotomy to this character that I recognize from other product. Everyone's like, "Oh, I want to watch this more."
Anglo, that's actually quite interesting. You've not seen Star Wars. Like, I think, if anything, that's
the
that...
only one I've ever met who's like not seen any Star Wars.
I'm like not a very I don't consume. I've always been kind of anti-consumerist.
Nah, that's not consumption, man. That's fucking Christmas in like 2006. All your family's around. Let's watch Star Wars. That's not consumption, man. That's like a classic family moment.
I know it. See, I still give Anglo credit for being the aloof Ubermensch culture in this regard, but you know,
actually,
the fact that like I was 3 years old when I first saw episode one, and it was just hooked because it's like guns and swords and explosions, other cool things that little boys like when they're 3 years old, then we'll just glom onto without any questioning because you're a 3 year old. You know, bright lights, loud noises. That's what little boys want.
I've actually did see one Star Wars like 3 years ago when that new one came out, but that
fucking ruined the entire thing then. What the fuck, man?
I didn't know anything. It's like everyone in the movie theater was clapping when Han Solo came in. It was like embarrassing.
That's very gay.
Yeah.
That's extremely gay.
Yeah,
like, this is interesting. This is interesting, man. You've never seen the old Star Wars is, but you know who Han Solo is.
Yeah, no, that is. I know all the characters.
All of them.
I used to know the whole storyline. I never even seen it. Because my friends would always talk about
it. Tells you so much about the cultural sort of, status that Star Wars has. It's prestige.
Was like for me and Harry Potter, halfway, maybe even more than halfway for the Harry Potter series as the books came out, when they were coming out at that point, I was young enough where my family was like, okay, we don't want you interacting with this media and product about witchcraft because that's evil and that's not Christian, and we won't let you read the books. And I was upset about it for, a little bit, but, I had Star Wars to satiate me, so I guess I couldn't be that angry about it. Among other things that satiated my need for product as a child in America.
I never even got into Pokemon either.
That's another thing, but we've already talked about that previously.
Have you guys seen Ryan Fork's stuff about Pokemon? Or he mentions Pokemon in that video. You guys seen that?
I've seen his stuff on Pokemon. I have seen
it. He talks about it in a video about microtransactions and like what he calls chemical slavery. I mean, he really lights up that spot that they were just making money off of like these kids that are addicted to. Just go watch his video on that if you want to take on it. But like, it's really interesting stuff. I mean, that guy's got some good takes, I think.
One thing I think about sometimes is that if my family actually came from like, solid money, I probably would have had all of my childish cries for product satiated, by going out and buying the video game or the card game, whatever.
Would have made you a shitter person.
And I would have been spoiled on that. But because we had that, financial deprivation, my parents had no choice but to say, no, we're not going to buy you that.
Yeah. Yeah, that's something that if you were never told that must, we're kind of like... essentialists for the most part. And I think, like, if someone's genetically going to be a cunt, then they're going to be a cunt. But
yeah,
that must make a lot of cunts all the same, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Wait, so Pokemon started as a game before a TV?
Yeah. Oh, they had this whole plan, and then they got...
So it was a game, and then they're like, oh, we should sell... We'll make a TV show to sell more games?
It was done, like, so quickly afterwards that it was all kind of orchestrated, I think.
Huh.
It was a planned Japanese assault on American society, as South Park tells us. Chin Pokemon. Doesn't that mean penis?
I don't know.
Penis or some shit. Oh, no. Fucking South Park's great, man.
There's something with Aussies in South Park.
Yeah? Is that a thing? Maybe it appeals to our irreverent sense of humor. Maybe we just like it because they say cunt.
Yeah, that's probably it. Yeah, Pokemon. Yeah. I always used to make fun of those kids that would play it during recess.
Oh, fuck you, that was me.
Yeah, well, I made fun of you, bro.
Well, you didn't, because you're, like, older than me, you fucking boomer.
Yeah. I was, like, the sixth grader, like, bullying all the kindergartners.
If you'd made fun of me, then you would have been like, sir, can you please leave this facility?
Yeah.
You, like, break into a fucking school in Australia just to take the piss out of a kid playing with Pokemon. What's wrong with you?
I did get into Dragon Ball Z. That was my thing.
That's fucking gay.
No, we did an analysis. I have no idea. It's Aryan.
Oh, shit. Yeah. It's super Saxon.
Yeah, there we go. Super Saxon.
I heard a guy do like a long take on how it's like super based. But yeah, I don't know, man. Isn't it like black people really likes Dragon
totally.
Ball Z?
Yeah, dude, you'll see like ghetto blacks and especially Mexicans.
That's cute.
It's very really big. Cute. It's very big in Mexico. And
man, this shop,
population.
I used to work in a shop in England, and like this one black guy I knew there, he was massively into Dragon Ball Z.
Yeah, Dragon Ball Z is really big with the POC community.
That's really weird. I wonder what it is.
Yeah, I remember when I was in kindergarten, I had a friend. He was his first year in America. He came from Mexico. He couldn't speak English. But the only thing that we had in common was we liked Dragon Ball Z.
That's cute.
It was like,
see, that's diversity. That's so good, you know?
We bonded over Dragon Ball Z.
The thing is, that's the kind of thing that cunts would actually like use to justify like immigration. Like they'd use that anecdote about you guys having zero ability to communicate.
Did you see that?
But we overcome it because we both liked Dragon Ball Z.
Did you see that post on Reddit? It was shared on Twitter where some guy was talking about his friend that died like 10 years ago.
Oh my God, yeah.
And he was lamenting over the fact that his friend didn't get to experience...
You know what?
Skyrim and Rick and Morty.
Yeah. Do you know what? I said after that, I tweeted the screen cap with the comment, I've never been given such a good set of reasons to fucking off myself in my life. Like this guy's reasons to not kill yourself literally sounded like a fucking... You know, like Xbox Live message that you'd get from some kid that was mad at you because he wanted you off yourself, you know?
Yeah, I reckon.
It's like the most, like, best reasoning I've ever heard to fucking end it all.
It's not like, oh, he could have had children.
Yeah.
He could have.
He could have consumed more shit. Yeah. He could have been around long. He could have been plugged into the drip feed for longer.
Yeah.
It's literally like what it is like is, oh, man. I'm such a shame that that chicken died. It could have stayed like in that fucking cage producing eggs for longer. Jesus Christ.
It's a very Matrix-like worldview, huh?
Hey, look at this. Man. In 2001, Saudi Arabia banned Pokemon games, alleging that their franchise promoted Zionism.
I don't know how they came to that one, but...
It's because they displayed the Star of David in trading cards.
No, it's because they're concerned about Pikachu.
Oh, and also as well as other symbols such as crosses that were on trading cards.
Fuck.
They associate with Christianity. And triangles they associated with Freemasonry.
That's based. Do you know, it was the weirdest fucking thing ever. Like my school, we went up to the, in like 2011, we went up to the cenotaph for the Remembrance Day. like in November the 11th, you know, the whole war thing. Yeah. And there was this guy there, this black fella, who had like all of these signs saying Steve McQueen murdered by Freemasons. And like all of these fucking people, he chose that one day to like pick it and say Freemasons are behind it all. And then he said no photos whenever anyone went to take a picture.
There are actually
that was
a lot of
real man.
A black Freemasons in the US.
That's based. Now, I can imagine black people would be really fun in a fraternity, you know, like.
Yeah.
I reckon that's where they'd flourish, you know.
Like, yo, did you know we used to run the world, dog?
Well, I'm sure, like, the black Israelites, I'm sure their fucking meetups are fucking amazing. They get up to some real shit, man.
What's up, brother in Yahweh? Speaking man, with Yahweh, the voice of the eternal, I say, welcome to thy meeting. They, like, use the words wrong.
Did you lads see that Yakub was reborn in India?
Oh, yes.
It's a fucking child. Baby was born with two brains.
My ancestor.
Yeah. He's the future. He's Arjuna. He's like the future leader of the Indian race as they become a superpower.
Mm. Yeah.
Well, you know, the descendants of Alexander. That's where they hail from, isn't the far reaches of the Hellenic Empire in the Indus River Valley.
Yeah, the Indo-European out of India theory.
Well, no, this is the into India theory.
Yeah.
You know,
but there's some Indians that say that like Indo-European languages originated in India because they can't stand the idea of like the whole Aryan invasion hypothesis.
Those are just salty Dalit niggas.
Well, yeah, they're Indian nationalists that are just, you know, like enraged at the idea of foreigners being responsible for everything good about their culture.
I can usually understand and, you know, find some novel entertainment in Indian nationalism, but not when it actually follows a consistent ethno-racial perspective.
Well, this is like, I've been reading into like formal theories of nationalism recently, and there was this it's like the theory modernism, which is purported by Eric Hobsbawm some others, which says that nations are essentially a creation of like post French Revolution modernity, and that they just kind of are literally just these invented things. And I think that that's not really fair because they are referential to like ethnic identities. But I think in the case of India, you can see like a clear example, and Pakistan, like clear examples of where people are trying to meme a nation into reality when it's not
like
really
Afghanistan as well.
Thing.
It's there's like,
oh fuck yeah, yeah.
Like a bunch of different tribes that have nothing in common. Like there are like some Turkic tribes, and here's like an Indo-Aryan tribe, and then here's this tribe
and all that.
Yeah, yeah. It's like, bro,
it's like Afghanistan is like, it's like if you ever played Risk, everybody's like choosing all of their territories, and then you have that one little like bit that's left over and no one wants. It's like Afghanistan is that, but its literal shape is determined by what nobody in the area else wants.
Yeah.
like you know that little corridor where that little chimney that Afghanistan has? That was like added in order to stop there being a land border between China and whoever else it was.
Lol.
Yeah, that panhandle. I don't know, like I think the thing with like the modernist, as it's called, account of the nation, I mean, it does have some validity to it in that it talks about how, you know, this that there is sort of to some degree a social construction of who the nation is as it sort of metastasizes out of a previous sort of ethnic continuum throughout the national territory. But at the same time, it treats everything that claims to be a nation with the same sort of like standards, where because like the big thing was that it's incidental and non-essential whether the nation does have a legitimate ethnic origin or not, was the sort of claim of this theory, that it's like some of them do have more ethnic cogency, but that's not essential to being a nation. But I think the big critique of that is that like you have nations like I would say the modern United States that is less legitimately called a nation than somewhere like Japan, you know, like,
yeah,
the modern United States has this disunity, and that disunity and that lack of ethnic cogency, I think, really takes away from the ability to kind of legitimately and authentically clear the nation.
That speaks to a question I wanted to ask you earlier about what you were describing as the English. Do you see that as a, you know, Britain-wide, you know, it's basically same border continuum as the modern UK, or do you see that as a, you know, classical understanding of England as opposed to the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish?
I mean,
at least Northern Irish.
Yeah, this is
minimum.
I mean, it's often quite tricky talking about this sort of thing, but like, I think in the same way as I was talking about, there's a difference between, say, Japan and Afghanistan and who can more legitimately call themselves a nation. I think in the same way, the English and England is far more easily identifiable as a legitimate nation than Britain is. I think Britain is, there is a genetic population of the British Isles that is definitely like identifiable. And like, you know, with very similar people. But I do think there is a delineation between the English, especially, and the other peoples of the British Isles. But also, I don't think it's like a completely absurd category to like put Scottish, Welsh, English, and Irish people together. Like Australia is perhaps clearly like a similar, British place.
Yeah, perhaps they're more similar as a group than they are as, I don't know, the people we try to group together as Nigerians.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. Oh, fucking oath, yeah. No, you're not wrong.
Major ethnic group divisions that exist there are, you know, anybody would agree with they're irreconcilable.
Yeah.
And the fact that Nigeria can exist as a unified country today is only possible because the two of these groups fought a war, you know, in the 20th century to make it so.
But yeah, like, I think there's sort of two stories with Britain and just England more specifically. The English are, we've always been somewhat of an imperial race, and that's expressed itself in Britain and ultimately the world. But yeah, I think, you know, the Scots and the English ultimately are pretty similar people, really. I think there are definitely distinctions, and Irish people would say that they couldn't be further from the English. But yeah, I think there is a distinction there, but I don't think it's totally illegitimate to talk about British people as being like an identifiable stock of like, and having certain characteristics. Like, you look at Australia, you can describe that as a British country, and Canada and New Zealand, you know, it's got a lot of English, but also a lot of Celtic people there, but there is like an identifiable Britishness as well as Englishness to those places, you know?
Certainly. And, you know, I guess, me personally would agree that's true to even more of an extent than the idea of Europeanness as a similar grouping. But, you know, we don't, as of present, we don't let Europeanness persuade us into this amalgamation, at least, you know, politically, beyond in international groupings such as the EU. So I'm interested to hear your thoughts on the movement for Scottish independence and perhaps what your thoughts were during the referendum.
Yeah, well, during the referendum, I was quite young, I have to say, but I've always been, in fact, it was, yeah, I was in Australia when the referendum happened still, but.
Really?
Yeah, I was. Huh. Yeah.
Wait, when did it happen again?
2014.
2014.
Yeah.
I think I was just. It was just around the time I moved. But yeah, I mean, I've always sort of seen. I've always been a fan of like the British Empire and things like that. Like, my dad's always sort of shown me like history books and stuff like that, and I've always been a fan of that kind of whole history, and I've always been inherently kind of proud of it. You know, I've always liked the film Zulu, so to speak.
it's a good movie.
So, oh, it's fucking cracker. But, you know, So I always, at the time especially, I did feel like, no, Scotland belongs in the UK and all of this. But nowadays, I think it's up to the Scots really to decide either way. And I think it could actually be a good thing for the English to, as we were saying earlier, become a nation again. Mm-hmm. And leave behind empire, perhaps decoupling this this project that is Britain could allow us to embrace a more organic mode of being. But it's up to the Scots, really.
It would strike me that you say this in spite of the English tendency towards the imperial. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah. But at the same time, I think that in many ways we need to put that behind us. Because we've lost ourselves in our projects and in our. Hello?
I think he's talking to somebody else.
Right on. But like in our sort of projects and in our kind of attempts to change things, and we've kind of lost our essential mode of being that we should re-embrace, I believe. I think Anglo's talking to his mum. Is he about to say, fuck off, mum, I'm saving the white race?
It sounds like it.
Yeah. But what about yourself? Like, I mean, you're.
How about you hold off on that until he comes back?
I don't think he knows he's not muted.
I'm muted on the recording, but not on the Skype.
Okay, that's all right.
But you count us back into the recording there. How about
Nikkei, you're obviously like you're like a Greek person, so the history of Greece has obviously been like under, I suppose, imperial and colonial domination by the Turks for a long time, and before that it was quite disjointed. But do you sort of think that the emergence of the sort of collective Hellenic identity as the invested in the Greek state, do you think that that's like an authentic sort of national thing?
I do. And I think primarily there is evidence linguistically as to the sort of natural affinity and closeness of these, you know, what existed in antiquity as
the Hellenes.
Different nations, different ethnos. I mean, literally the word ethnicity is nation. Yeah. Back then, you know, somebody who lived in Thebes and Corinth and Athens thought of themselves as different ethnicities. And if you think back to a sort of tribal mindset, where the city-state is the tribe, then this makes sense. However, there was a military consolidation, and I think that's why Alexander is considered the great, or Alexandros Omegas, the great, because he consolidated this stubborn group of people who insisted on their differences and would hold on to that till the very end. And what it really took was a military and violent subjugation to concede, okay, yeah, maybe we're more similar than we're willing to admit.
In the face of Persian, in the face of Persian domination, like.
Sure. You had some progenitors of this unity through things like the Delian League and the Sparta and its allies, where they could see themselves as people who could fundamentally get along together. And it's not
with turned its
allies into helots.
Yeah, true.
Okay,
true.
There's a difference between the allies and the helots.
Well, the Spartans were originally like from the islands of Greece, right? Or from like Crete, and then they migrated into the Peloponnesus. Mm-hmm. That's my understanding. And then they sort of subjugated the more local.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's why when not Xenophon, with the Melian dialogue, when all of that went down, that's why the, in Milos, that's why because the Spartans were kin to them. That's why they were on their side in that war. The Peneles, the Thucydides, that's him. That's
inherent recognition of that ethnic kinship.
Exactly, or, yeah.
You know, an extended tribal connection that means more than any other tribe around you. And it's that concession, which is, you might say, is the first earliest example of that stubborn independence and difference conceding to the reality of the people's similarity. And it's kind of interesting to, and I think it's funny to note the ancient Greeks' reluctance to this unified identity and the reluctance to concede the truth of this commonality.
But then they did know the difference between a fellow Hellene and a foreigner, like an absolute foreigner.
These differences, I think, can be put to sort of environmental factors that lead to, you know, within the same ethnic group, differences in culture, in day-to-day life that mean more in an ancient civilization than they do in a modern civilization where there are less salient differences between the cultural groups of a of one ethnicity.
Well, that you could make a cogent argument that in terms of like material existence and in terms of meaning, there's not much difference between being an Englishman and a Frenchman, or like a, you know, there's not much qualitative difference in the way and the mode of being and life from any of these places in the modern world. You know, if everybody just lives in city 1.0 to 20, then, you know, like everybody just lives the same kind of homogenized form of human life. So there's not really any meaningful distinction.
In that sense, I've sort of justified the epithets thrown at the National Socialists of a European conquest to Germanize all of Europe during the Third Reich, where, you know, what I would say is that unlike the French and the English, there was never that one final military conquest where everybody did have to concede this commonality. Because, you know, from a modern perspective, it's easy for us to see that, okay, a Theban and a Corinthian are far more alike than a Theban and a Persian.
Yeah. But then you got to think about how their entire world was Hellenic and how, like, I think identity works in sort of concentric circles, but they didn't have the immediacy of contact with non-Hellenic peoples to reorient their kind of disdain to somebody more further afield. Like, we don't really consider ourselves.
I don't know if that's true. I'd have to look into the historical fact of, you know, which city states and which tribes in Greece knew about the wider world. And
they knew about it, but that it's like definitely the case that in terms of encountering absolute foreigners, that was a less common thing than it would then sort of become as distance.
Yes.
You know, and this sort of widening scope throughout history sees a broadening of identity. So you identify, as soon as, you know, you have sort of people further afield, you start identifying at a wider level. This is why the idea of like a common human identity is retarded unless you discover aliens, you know, unless you discover someone else that's like on our level.
The same way that relative deprivation functions on a sociological level, this is exactly. Also true.
Yeah, it's somebody to compare yourself to, somebody that's like a competition in the run.
You have to admit there is something even more significant in terms of, you know, actual difference when you can understand what a foreigner is saying versus when you can't.
Yeah.
And I think that
totally.
I draw to that linguistic commonality to say that the ancient Hellenic peoples were a natural fit for the modern Greek, in that they shared this linguistic commonality that they didn't share with other people. And that distinction is pretty evident towards this case. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I agree.
Well, I gotta get going, Goyi.
You're really gonna cut us off here?
I mean, I could record a bit. I just won't be around. I could maybe continue the recording while you guys.
I gotta go to bed pretty soon, but I could finish this little conversation and then I could take off.
I think we should.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah. I mean, maybe it's
save the rest for next time, huh?
Yeah.
Aren't you going to continue?
Oh, I thought Nikkei was going to.
Yeah.
That was all I was going to say.
Oh, okay.
Well, I've kind of lost the thread now, so you might as well bookend it there.
Yeah.
Well, very well.
Good conversation, though, Nikkei. Yeah.
Yes, likewise. I enjoy talking about these sort of things because
history.
You know, it's sort of what I've had as my, you know, central unifying point of reference throughout my life is this ancient history that I've always been so fascinated with.
And oh, same.
I have that ethnic connection to. And, yeah. You know,
well,
one of the greatest tragedies, I think, for the rest of European civilization is that they don't have this same record classical available to them to learn from today. You know, the ancient people of Scandinavia at the same time, you know, the records of what they thought and what they were discussing at the time don't exist to this day. So we have this conception of the, you know, just mindless bloodthirsty Viking who just all he knows is rape and pillage. When that probably wasn't the case. They probably had a similar civilizational outlook, you know, insofar as they thought about these things the same way that Mediterranean people did, but they just didn't have the same technology to record that as the Mediterranean peoples did.
Yeah. Well, yeah, this was a really good fucking conversation anyway. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, no problem.
We definitely need to have you back.
Oh, cheers. Yeah, and shameless plug, YouTube, Evening Star,
Yeah, check that out. Check out that National Idealism video.
I will.
Yeah, that's the best one.
There are questions I didn't even get to yet regarding that video on itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, that's the one I'm most proud of, and then there's another two that are all right, I think. So I'll probably make a few more soon.
Yeah, keep on doing that. Good.
Yeah, cheers.
Yeah, hopefully I'll see you on EBL. But my name is Angelo. Yeah. With me I have Nikkei, and thank you guys for listening.
As always.
Thank you for listening. If you want to give us young lads some help, send us some Bitcoin. Our BTC address is in the description. See you next week.